See, and you had to kick him out. No, he's a twin, and I love them. I have twins as well.
Yeah, you have
Identical.
twins?
Identical girls, yeah.
No
So,
way. Oh, that's right.
dude,
Yeah, I saw that. They're
twins are interesting. They're either really wonderful or they give you the blues, and
Are they identical?
they're identical. And they were girls, but I might as well have had like 12 boys. I mean, it was, I didn't know if I was coming or going.
Yeah, I can imagine.
My God. Anyhow, enough of that. Hi.
Hey.
Thank you. Thank you for taking some time to chat with me.
No problem at all. Yeah, my pleasure.
Have a bunch of questions. I don't usually run it where I'm just sitting here with a list of questions in front of me. Like nobody wants to do, like, well, maybe somebody wants to do it, but I don't.
It's all right.
But I wanted to start out by asking you, shoegaze.
Yeah.
What is it? Number one. And number two, I'm not being funny. Kind of. How do you feel about being called like some one of the original founders of shoegaze, and things like that? Do you feel like that's a jacket you guys wear? Like, how do you stand on that? Because I
No,
saw quite a bit of that.
I wouldn't say we were founders of it, but we were around when everybody else was starting out. Someone always asked me, am I influenced by other bands at that time? And I'm like, well, I didn't really know about them because we were just starting out ourselves. It's kind of hard to say. I was influenced by, my buddy Valentine when we were both starting at the same time. But in the end, we all influence each other, if you know what I mean.
And what does that term mean to you, shoegaze? Because I remember I was into punk,
Well, it
and
started with this dude. You heard this band called Moose before?
I don't think so.
Well, Moose was a band that the guy is a guy named Lincoln Fong that does all the he did all the 4AD engineering and co-producing and some stuff, and he did a lot of stuff with Robin Guthrie. He was the main
Okay.
engineer for Cocteau Twins when we were at when we were at September Sound in 1989. He went on to produce us, but he also played with G's and Mary Chain. He played with a band called Moose, and Moose had an interview one time with a guy from the NME, which was a big magazine back then. And the guy said that he came in with some. He looked like a gothic kind of guy. He had sparkly shoes on, but his style of interviewing was to intimidate them. And he says he came and he says, "Ooh, what kind of shoes are you guys wearing?" Hence the term shoegaze.
No way.
It was an insult to them. To it was a deemed as a boring thing. To see people just do that all the, if you're really into that kind of thing, but it was deemed a boring kind of thing. But it was a thing that was happening at the time that no one really knew what it was, but they called it that. But it didn't really catch on till like I say, like 2000, it came back, something like that,
With
and
My Bloody Valentine and Cocteau Twins and that
yeah,
kind of a thing.
all those bands tended to break up around 1996, 97, but a lot of them, got back together, when we kept playing and kept playing and kept playing and playing and kept playing with people, in the past, so we never really stopped playing. So one day this guy said, "Yo, man, this is something they got called shoegaze." I'm like, "Shoegaze?" And then like it was a young kids are like they like that kind of stuff now. So it's good to see that, very good to see, it's just weird. It's just to see like how it caught up. We were deemed over with back in the late 90s, if you know what I'm saying, right?
And you weren't, yeah.
No, yeah, because the Seattle thing happened, the boy band thing happened. But you see, I always thought that the music had a chance to didn't have a chance to expand because Robin Guthrie was working with this guy from this band called Seafeel, and Seafeel kind of was doing like remixes for him at the time, and Robin never really let anybody do anything with him at all, but it became ambient and kind of like intrusive on kind of like not drone, but kind of like it's a like kind of remix thing he was heading there. And then him and Liz broke up, and I'm like, God damn, dude. It was just almost right. there. I could see where it was going, you know what I'm saying? You know? And then by that time, you know, people getting divorced and all this kind of junk like that, you know, when all the, one thing led to another. So, and trip hop came into the fray. And it came into the fray. And I began to work with a lot of DJs in New York at the time. Working with this guy, Carlos Best, that produced Wu-Tang Clan.
Mm-hmm.
He did some work with them. And I became his assistant for a minute on a few things.
Wow.
And I played guitar on that song called Shay Shay La Ghost. And Tommy Mottola.
You know, I know guitar. That song.
I played guitar. And not that you really hear it, or I got paid for it, but I played on it. But it goes face. I mean, he was in the studio, I came to the studio early, and he was in there, right, with a big ass falcon on his arm, and he's watching TV, right, and I came in for the session, and he looked at me, and says, "You work here?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm working with Carlos in here," like. He's gonna like chop my head off, you know, like
wow,
goes fake. Yeah. But working with him and then working on a few sessions, the house music sessions and stuff like that. After that, you know, oh, Lyricist Lounge too.
There,
you know, mm-hmm. Lyricist Lounge.
Yes.
Yeah. We did some stuff with Mos Def too. That was never released, really. You know, some kind of shit. It'd be like. Most definitely second up with some shoegaze stuff. He did some stuff. A friend of mine gave him a demo, right? I don't know how mm-hmm. he got a hold of it. But anyway, he's singing over one of our songs, you know?
Really? You know, nothing he does surprises me. Most is so creative.
Oh, this is so old. This is like 2004. But we never really put it out properly, though. I think we need to put that out at some point, you know?
That's that would really, be cool to hear.
It's definitely a conversation piece, definitely. But it's been an interesting.
So how do you feel? Because you were saying they back in the day they were like, you guys are, you're done pretty much, or you're not. What not relevant? What did they say? And then how did you get past that? Like how did you keep evolving?
By saying this, they said that.
Exactly.
I didn't really get the memo. Actually, to tell you the truth, you know. Because I always felt like that soul music had a, you know, I mean, if you've ever noticed lately, there's not really any R&B songs out there that's really singing to women, so to speak. I mean, I like soul music, you know, and, you know, I like that idea of soul, you know, I like songs about women and just, you know, being in love, that kind of junk, you know, but it's very rare these days, unless you punching a bitch or something like that these days, you know. And I think it's a lost art. But rather than stuff down somebody's throat, just kind of like flip it and make it kind of like, not shoegazy, but kind of like, kind of ambient. You know what I'm saying? Ambient, just some ambient shit. Like, you know, like Tricky or something like that, you know? That kind of vibe, you know? But that's the sound of the future, don't you think?
I think so. You know what I think is that... I think we got so caught up in doing all these the futuristic sounds and finding the new sound and all of this that we kind of got away from the soul of music. And I feel like we went so far that now we're going backwards. And
right.
And that all of that soulfulness is coming back. Here at home, I listen to like the Delta Blues all the time. I love the blues.
Oh, yeah.
I found myself getting tired of what's out right now and going backwards and wanting to listen to old soul, yes, old blues, because that's where it started, right?
Yeah.
And so eventually you go back to where it started. And I think that that's what's going to go on. If it's not already, we're going to go back to our roots, so to speak, as far as music is concerned. And I think it's a good thing.
I can't see going where it's going now, you know. I mean, I don't know, man. As a woman, I'd be like, what's something that's really moving me? You know what I'm saying? I'm like, what? You know, what's some stuff for me? You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't get it. You know, that's like you like this kind of, like, you remember that, you know, the Quiet Storm is?
Of course. Of course. I love imitating the Quiet Storm DJs.
Now, imagine that. Imagine that at decibel 1,000. The Quiet Storm.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's, see, the idea was to make a band that could play like my, like, say, for example, like, you know, when you turn the TV on, it's static, but it's a melody, you know, it's a cacophony of melody, you know, but somebody singing soul over it, you know what I'm saying? Like Flying Saucer Attack, you know?
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. It's,
yeah.
There's a lot of soul missing now, I think. And what you were saying, as far as women in music, I don't feel like they sing to us anymore. Mm-hmm. They sing at us and they sing about us, but they don't sing to you. And I think that's how I ended up, again, like the old blues musicians, they said exactly what they meant. Yeah. You didn't have to try to figure it out. If they loved their baby, you knew they loved their baby. And if they were mad at her and whatever else, you knew that too. But yeah, now they sing at us. They don't sing about us anymore.
And this is what we call forbidden frequencies.
Yes. 100%.
Yeah.
What's it like performing with your brother? Like, how did you both end up musicians, number one? And you came from North Carolina, correct?
Yes.
What was it like being you guys in North Carolina doing the music that you were doing, being into what you were into?
An early age? I mean, we were in different bands back in the day. I mean, I played in church and he played in the juke joint. He played in the juke joint with these older dudes that were like, you know, and you know, they were just out of high school, something like that. And he was one of the younger guys in the band that sounded like Prince at the time. So they would play all these adult places in downtown Raleigh and in the backwoods and stuff like that, you know. And he'd be, you know, the front dude, whatever else, and he's getting away with it. So he'd be coming home Saturday morning and I'd be going to church to play Sunday morning. So we praise each other like that. So, you know, and so then I went to play in church over there for like maybe about 4 or 5 months, something like that, you know. I just started playing, you know. And then maybe 6 months I got fired for playing too loud, something like that, you know.
You know what you got fired for.
They were like, no, you can't play like them white boys. I'm like, I like them white boys. What are you talking about? You know, man. And I come with, like, I got a flying V and other shit like that. Oh, sorry. Stuff like that. You know, like,
you're fine.
And yeah, they're like, you playing too loud, son. So then that's 1983. So that's the same time I was going to hardcore punk shows back in the day. I was in a punk band called Sacred Cows at the time with some friend of mine, Rob Stewart, and God bless his soul, and a couple of other guys that played. You know, it would be the pop-up band that would play in between bands. So we could have them play. We could have them play and shit like that in between the bands, between other punk bands, hardcore bands, why not, you know. Just make up stuff all on the spot and whatnot, you know. And there was our first show was at a hardcore punk show opening up for this band called Corrosion of Conformity.
How funny! We had Mike Dean of Corrosion of Conformity was on the podcast. And,
really? Yeah, I don't
mind. Yeah, actually getting ready to, you know, he left the band.
Yeah, I know.
And he's playing now in North Carolina in his new band.
I know.
Isn't that crazy? What a small world. I love Mike. We kind of grew up together. What? No.
Yeah.
Okay. It was an interesting interview because he's so mellow and quiet.
Yeah.
And so it took me a minute to really get to pull him into, you know, having the conversation. But that's funny you said that. Interesting. A lot of talent coming out of North Carolina, apparently.
Our first hardcore punk show was... with opening up for them, Neon Christ, and Marginal Man. The guy Neon Christ, when he was saying for Allison Chains now.
Yes.
The brother did. So that's how vibrant it was back then. You know, we didn't even have a drummer there back then. We had a drum machine back then, kind of like we do now sometimes. But it was like, you know, you could really do anything. You know, we weren't really like, you know, a hardcore band, but we kind of fit in with that kind of scene of people, you know what I'm saying? They were embracing us because, you know, we couldn't go do the stuff in no black club. They were like, get the hell out of here during that time, you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, it was a really good scene to be around at that time, from what I remember, you know?
So I was raised in the Southern Baptist Church as well. My family here in California, my family, they're from Texas, Georgia, those kind of places.
Amen.
And I encountered more, like, I don't want to use the term hater, ration, holleration. Anyway, yeah. I, from my family, when I started to get into the stuff I was into, it was like they didn't understand it. And
you're mad. You
know, I always had that feeling of not fitting in anymore once I got really into to rock and alternative. Did you experience that feeling as well in North Carolina? Like,
yeah, of course I did. Called faggot, punk, white boy, you name it. I got all that.
Me too.
Now, everybody looks like that. Look, everybody looks like I did when they were calling me a punk and a faggot now.
You know, I was just saying that recently, because I'm a little bit upper. My God, I'm tired. I'm a little older than I look. And so I was there. You know, I was always I was one of the only people, quote unquote, of color. That's what they call us now. At some of these shows.
Do you remember the Apollo moon landing?
I'm not that seasoned. Right.
See, yes,
but I'm younger than you, but older than I look. So, but I remember being the only one for a while. And then now these kids are like, looking how I was looking back then when they were talking smack to me, right?
I know.
It's in and it's cool and you could buy it at the store. It's crazy. Right?
Yeah, wait.
I've been doing this. I tell them all the time, I've been doing this.
Oh, I just don't wear this on weekends. You know, I'm not a weekend person with the shit, you know?
Yes, that's interesting. I asked that because I find that a lot of us have the same experience as far as that goes, where you're like,
yeah, it sucked.
It sucked, and you're at this like really awkward, interesting phase, and I feel like we paved the way for the kids now, right? So that they could just go and be themselves, right?
They can order that shit online now. We made it.
Dude, yeah. They can.
We made our stuff.
And they're just like, oh, I like how you have those spots and stains. I'm like, dude, that's from when somebody's knee, their tooth hit my knee. And this is from when his boot barely grazed my head. And yeah, this shirt wasn't made. It was made from going to shows and yeah, being in the mix.
It wasn't worn. It wasn't, what do you call it? Distressed.
It pre-worn.
Yeah, distressed.
It was distressed because I was getting jacked up in it. That's why it was distressed.
Yeah.
100%. But yeah, what's it like playing with your brother?
Oh, I forgot about that. Oh, yeah, him.
You know that guy.
It's okay. I mean, imagine, if you will, waking up with a rash that just won't go away.
I don't want to. No, thank you.
No. Or either, let me get another analogy. You know, like we grew up together, the twin stuff in the beginning and whatnot. And we didn't really think we were going to be working together at one point in time because we had different kind of ideas, you know. But we really clicked together was when we wrote our first song together, which is called The Color Loves Blue. And we dedicated that to a friend of ours who just passed away not too long ago. Mm. But the collaborative part is good, but you know, then it works sometimes and sometimes it doesn't work sometimes, you know. But sometimes you got to be kind of I don't want to say diligent about things that we do, because the choices that we make song wise sometimes might be good or bad, but sometimes you have to accept what he thinks is good. You know what I'm saying? So that's how things work sometimes, you know. He writes most of the lyrics sometimes, and I write some of the lyrics sometimes, you know, but Hayato programs some of the stuff. Some of the stuff that we come up with, he programs all of it, and we just give him the idea, and then we'll, like, you know, send things back and forth because we don't live in the same place. But the band is basically just me, Daniel, and Hayato, and sometimes we use other people that we know. Alex Cox, which is a original member of the band from the late 90s. We have kind of like, you know, a revolving door of people that come in, like Martin and Emery, you know, so we kind of keep it going, like, because it's like there's so many guitars on the recording. If you know about the Cocteau Twins, right, they do they layer stuff, right? And when you layer some of the guitars, they do different things, they create different kind of melodies. So we try to capture the same thing live, because I use about 10 or 15 guitars for the layering. So sometimes it works, sometimes it does work, you know, depending upon if we rehearse or not. So, you know, but I like that kind of ambient kind of sound, you know what I'm saying? Kind of, you know, like, this is what I call the quiet storm, that kind of ambient mix of guitar.
Yes.
You know, the vibrant kind of thing. You know, it could be the ocean kind of sound, but it could be just all feedback and distortion, you know, and that clown singing over it.
Not the clown.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, because I know with having being a twin and everything.
Yes, it works out like that, though. You know what I'm saying? You know.
You guys are like magnets. That's what. That's why I described it. Either you're coming together or you're pushing apart. There's like no in between. It's like I found that they either wanted to be really close or they wanted to split and be their own people. So it was really, really interesting. They would fight all day long, and then when they would fall asleep, they would be laying next to each other when they were babies, between like birth and like three, all day, like fighting. And then when I would put them, I even one time put one on one side of the room and one on the other. And within 20 minutes, they were laying, holding each other again. And it was so funny, because then they would wake up and be like, get off me. So I really think that it's interesting that you guys ended up, you know, in a band, the band. Together.
Yeah. That's been, 1986.
That's a minute.
Been playing that long, you know, so I don't know. I never thought about doing anything else, really. I mean, it hadn't been a bed of roses, and like, don't get me wrong, because, you know, I've been married, divorced, other kind of junk like that, you know. But one thing I didn't lose sight of was my desire to create. And sometimes it's not really on everybody's agenda. You know what I'm saying? So you got to make your sacrifices and make your choices clear when you get involved with people that you spend a lot of time with. It's not for everybody, you know. So, you know, people got lives, you know.
That's a good question. That just popped in my head too, because do you ever had to pick? You pick between music and your partner? Don't you most of the time you pick the music, don't you?
I just said I was divorced.
No, that's why I'm asking. You pick the music. You music is your first love and your partner is your second one. And
I can't, you know, I used to hold grudges about things like that, but it's like, you can't blame people for wanting a certain way of living. You know what I'm saying? I can't, you know, be upset about that or really hold it against anybody. You know what I'm saying? You know, I mean, you come to know that, look, you should have made those amends before you got involved, you know? You know, it's not for everybody, you know? But I don't have any regrets from then on about what I've chosen to do musically, though.
Right. Music always wins.
I enjoy what I do now, you know.
So what are you guys working on currently, as far as music? Anything new? New releases, new recordings. What are you doing?
Yeah, we just came back from the UK with the Chameleons. And we've been working on like two or three things that we've been working on for the last couple of years now since the pandemic. You know, we got like another record called Evergreen that we're going to put out. And it's going to have like a couple of remixes by some people that we've been working with, or just some, it's going to be an amalgamation of mixes that we've been doing, experimenting with beats and stuff like that right lately, you know, more kind of like DJ culture kind of thing a little bit. Kind of like, you know, do you like vaporwave?
What would be considered vaporwave? An example.
Muzak, kind of like Muzak.
Yes.
New Muzak as but it's a thing that it's kind of an old thing now, but vaporwave is kind of like where these DJs incorporate kind of beats and things with kind of screwed down tracks and 80s kind of music, you know.
Nice.
And put it in a Japanese kind of nostalgia kind of video like that. It's kind of like that. It's called vaporwave, you know. And there's a couple of like mixes, and it's kind of morphed into all this new DJ culture stuff now, where they're doing songs now of their own. They're actually playing things, you know. So that's what I listen to the majority of the time is vaporwave, you know. There's a lot of that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of words. No. Just sounds.
Just sounds. You know, you can come up with your own words just by listening to that kind of stuff like that. You know, it'll give you ideas. You know, and it's like, how do I describe it? It's like, it's a channel, but they play this stuff back to back, you know, and it's like a stream of consciousness, you know, somewhat, you know, and the beats come in and out of focus and whatnot. And all I do is imagine, like, man, what would it sound like if I put a guitar to that right there? Or either, what if this beat or something like that? Or what if Nina Simone sung over this kind of guitar melody, you know, those kind of ideas, you know?
Like so that. it sounds like it gets your creative juices flowing, so to speak, when you listen to it.
Yeah, I like stuff like that. I like being creative. I like doing stuff like that, you know. I mean, I never stop. You know,
I think it's interesting that those people can now, DJs are selling out big, you know, arenas, and all they're doing is playing those different sounds and tones.
Look at me started.
Isn't that?
You know it's bad when the DJ sounds better than you do in the band.
Right. No, because I have a friend that's into that.
I hate that.
And they pay money to go, and it's just a DJ spinning lights and smoke, and they're there for like 3 hours, and they're dancing.
To watch them?
to listen. I don't know. To dance to it. Like, I still haven't been grasped that whole concept yet.
This is one thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one thing, but I wouldn't stand there and watch him. I mean, I don't know, you know. I don't want to sound like I'm some old dude, but I'm some old dude, and I wouldn't be standing there.
Yeah, I haven't wrapped my mind around it yet. I've been invited to go to hear someone play. Are they playing? How do you hear a DJ play? What is that? I don't know.
Go see him play, or
What is it, right? But I think that's interesting. It seems like those sounds is what kind of motivates you and gets you creative and wanting to.
Well, these days, yeah. You?
What about me?
So what gets you motivated?
I like sounds, but I like words. I like words too. And I think I'm in my feelings a lot.
Is that right?
I'm in my feelings a lot. I feel how I feel, and then my logical side comes in and I try to dissect why I feel that way. It's like something I do. I'm angry. Why am I angry? And then I just take it all the way back, and usually I'll figure out like what's really the root of whatever it is. And I get a kick out of that, believe it or not. That also might be an in your head Gemini thing. I don't know. But I was going to ask about the double guitar. I'm like fascinated with it. I think they're beautiful.
Thanks. Thanks.
Why do you need two at once? What is the idea behind the double guitar? I think they're beautiful, but
because I'm lazy, I don't want to take bring along two separate guitars.
That's not it. It can't be the only reason.
No. I wanted to say I wanted this vintage double neck, right? But I can't afford them. So they made these things called Telstars, which are just Japanese vintage guitars, like 67. So, but they come with a bass neck, right? So I just kind of Afro engineered it and put a 12 string neck on it, on both of them, right? And then, you know, kind of made it my own kind of thing, you know, because, you know, I'm like, okay, what can I do to make this look as vintage as I can, you know, use my imagination, right? And so I just used it and did that, you know. So we made both of them like that.
That's neat. And you play it all, do you ever put it down and just play a regular guitar? You pull out your old Flying V, like, or you, that's what you play all the time?
No, I don't have it. Unfortunately, I don't have it anymore, unfortunately. But I play any number of them. But I just took the double neck because I couldn't afford to take the other guitar. But it worked out all right. But I have maybe like 18. So out of the 18, maybe I use the Jaguar the most, though. You know, my Jaguar and my Fender Mustang.
Nice.
Yeah, but the double necks, yeah. I'm actually kind of making a. Do you know what an Ebow is?
I think I do. Tell
like
me.
You hold it in your hand. It's like a vibrator. You cut it on. There's a light that comes on.
Yes.
You put it on the string and it vibrates.
Okay. Right?
So I'm gonna put a pickup that's made to activate the strings like that by itself on the.
Interesting.
So it'll activate the string when I play it. So I don't have to hold it in my hand. So I'm gonna use like my friend's gonna wire it for me. He's gonna put it in. So they have a little light on it when it comes on and stuff like that. So I'll show you.
Always updating it for fun.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah.
I always say there's something about guitarists and their pedals and chords. pedals and chords. I'm like, what are you talking? Like, now I get it. But at first I used to be like, what? And now I understand. There's like a whole fascination. Sometimes you guys mess with them. You don't even need to be.
No,
you need to be.
No.
You don't.
Yeah, man, if you heard one delay, you heard them all pretty much. They'll come out with a brand new one. I'm like, okay. Okay. All right. Then there's another one. There's another one that's better than this one. All right. Well, this one does the same thing. So. There's so much out there that you can do. But, you know, when it comes down to it, it all matters if you, what kind of song are you going to write with it? You can have many pedals as you want, but what about the song? You know what I'm saying? You know, there's a lot of bands that make a lot of noise out there, but you got to remember some songs these days, though, you know? And I think that there's a lot of good bands out there coming out there like that now, you know?
So my thinking, I believe that art, music and fashion go together.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Who are some of your influences as far as art? Let's talk art. If you were talking about a favorite artist that you see their work and it motivates you or inspires you, who would that be?
I used to live down the street from, I still live down the street from Jean-Michel Basquiat studio in on 3rd Street. I live in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And just one of my biggest influences when I was in high school, when I was coming up, my art teacher told me, oh, Danny, there's somebody in the New York Times I think you should check out. There's this young black guy that's in Lower Manhattan making a big come up with his art. You should check him out. And she gave me the magazines. Oh, Jean-Michel Basquiat. He was still alive at the time.
Wow. Yeah.
About him and whatnot. And I remember seeing him on MTV and whatnot, you know. But when I lived down in New York, some of those same people from that congregation of his time were still living down there at the time.
Mm.
A lot of the artists that were living downtown were just kind of fading out a little bit
late 80s, early 90s, no?
Yeah, kind of something like that, yeah. New York was changing a lot. It was really getting kind of, you know, it's getting really kind of gentrified by the time we got there. We moved there in 1993. You know, I've been living there since 93. And because the Hells Angels were my neighbors at the time.
Oh, and that's nice.
Yeah, it was great. It was they saved the block majority of the time.
Wow.
But they got bought out by NYU for $100 million.
No, I did not know. So how did you go from North Carolina to I'm in New York? Like, how did?
Well, when we got signed to PolyGram, we decided we wanted to go to live near the record company and handle business, you know, because we didn't really have a manager at the time. You know, we actually never really had a manager, actually, you know.
No, never?
No. I mean,
that's interesting.
The majority of the things that we've done, people was done without a manager, and the people came to us. All the tours we've done, from the Cocteau Twins, the Jesus and Mary Chain, Pixies.
The Pixies.
Yeah, Jesus and Mary Chain. They asked us to play. You know what I'm saying?
So
they spent the decade from 88. We opened for Throne, you know Throne Muses?
Yes.
We opened for Throne Muses that time. Fishbone, a couple of times, Living Color, Spies, HR, you know. It was, yeah, man. It was we've been really lucky though. I can't complain, man. Really can't. I'd be amiss to say that we haven't been, you know, we had some good, you know, breaks, you know, and we had a lot of bad breaks as well. So
I find it interesting that you said I never wanted to be anything else. You know how long some people it takes them to figure that out, that this is what they want to be and this is what they want to do. I've always admired people that were like, no, this is just what I am. This is what I do. And I'm not doing anything else. I admire that. I do.
I feel like when you go on a date with somebody, you tell them what you are. You're like, I'm a musician. Like you just told us that you're branded or some shit like that, you know, but you gotta, I mean, it's this decade of things that we're doing right now. Yeah. I'm surprised that young kids even have the stamina to be into music these days and have their own ideas, since they're influenced by so many things on the internet. I mean, our resources were less than theirs, right? So we drew from different kind of things, though. But they're drawing from even more information than we ever had to be creative. You know what I'm saying?
I do. I try to keep up, and I check out some newer artists. And it's interesting when I'm listening, I hear a little bit of all of us, if you know what I mean. I hear it in their music. Just little pieces, I go, hey, you know, and I think they just kind of take little tidbits and throw it together, and there it is. But again, you have to have a good foundation, right, to make something great. And so
you're right. You're right, exactly.
Their foundation is us. And so, yeah. So you guys are recording anything new now? You said you are. Where are you going to play next?
We're going to play in April. We're going to do our East Coast tour. Starts in Minneapolis.
Okay, you guys coming out here anytime soon to the West?
Well, we're thinking about coming out to San Francisco to play some cafes out here. We're thinking about it. Just kind of like taking a break out there. Are you close?
Who, me? To San Francisco?
Yeah.
San Francisco in the car is about 5.5 hours.
Oh, word.
It's about a 45-minute flight. It's right over there. It's not too far.
You said flight?
It's a 45-minute flight, and it's a 5.5 hour in the car. I used to go up to the Bay, up to Oakland and all those places, and hang out quite a bit. They had a hell of a punk scene up there. And I used to go up there all the time. So it's not that far.
Cool.
I'll definitely listen. I don't turn down any invites to go check out good music. So
okay, we gotta make plans, man. Okay, as soon as I get some confirmation, we gotta make plans.
Let me know. We'll come check you out. Yeah,
definitely. You know, and also, I think What I'll do, I'll send you a link to all the new stuff that we're doing.
Please.
Yeah.
If and that. I'll send you some of our merch. Okay, so the merchandise that we have, the designs are mine. I drew them all. I like hand sketch them, and then I have a digital person that helps me like digitize it and everything. But those are all my actual ideas. Like one of the shirts, I got banned off of Meta when it first came out.
Yeah.
Because it had the phrase Black Lives Matter in it. The shirts say Black Punk Lives Matter. If you look on my page, there's a picture of Walt, Dirty Walt, wearing it.
Yeah.
But I put out, the clothing line came before the podcast. That's what I was doing initially, was just designing and drawing and things like that. Definitely not an artist. I don't consider myself one. But
Yes, you are. You talk, what do you mean?
I'm artistic. I don't know that I'm an artist. But
as an art, yeah. As an art to which everything that you do, you know.
As that's artist, true.
As an artist, this, you have the art of talking to me and telling, you know, asking me questions and whatnot, you know. I don't do that so well.
You're doing fine. So the other member of the band, not you, not your brother.
Hayato.
Tell me about him. How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, Hayato came at a turbulent time when I was in the middle of my divorce. And he came, like, you know, at a time right when I needed him, man, you know. So he and I began to work on music together right after, you know, the Velt stopped playing a lot, you know, and we wanted to get another project started called Apollo Heights. And that's right when trip hop and stuff was really beginning to take off. And I began to work with a couple of DJs right when my brother moved back to North Carolina. So what I would do with P. Diddy would have like a mixtape that would come out every other Thursday every other month, right? Mm-hmm. You could go to the block up here, right, and get a mixtape that had every new hip hop song that was coming out, but they would be remixes of them. Like they would be these independent DJs that would have mixes of popular rap song, but they would be like
really kind
of freaked out versions of them, right? So I would take the tapes, right, and put it in a little sampler and mm-hmm. play to them like that, like, you know, come up with ideas and, like, you know, let it with a DJ sampler. And so I began to get a new body of work together by that time, you know, because at the time I was listening to Tricky, Massive Attack, Portishead, and
I love Portishead.
Yeah, and Omar Chiba by that time. Okay. And because I had the fortune of working with Massive Attack on 100th Window demos, the demos for 100th Window. I had to play guitar.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And dude, with the grace, Liz Frazier got me that job. God bless her. So, you know, all that stuff had influenced us at that time, and Hayato began to get proficient on programming when I met him, you know. So we did our first demo together, which is Aurora Borealis, that you can hear on Marigolds. It's a remix that we did together. Our first thing we did together was that. And he's really into soul music and whatnot. You know, he's good at programming, and he has a very good temperament between me, my brother, and I. So I won't kill him sometime.
There it is. Yes.
He's a conduit, you know. He always says, "Well, your brother says," you know, like, because of like that. So
he's a mediator.
Yeah, him and his wife Marie helps out because she translates a lot of stuff. Because his Japanese, his English is horrible, and our Japanese is not that great. Well, I can get around a little bit, you know. From so we studied a little bit of Japanese for a minute.
Oh, just, wow!
Just 1982, we bought the Japanese curriculum to our public school system.
We were
in high school. We were so much of a nerds back then. Well, we still are nerds because no one was really into that kind of like anime stuff back then, you know. So we got a scholarship to go to Japanese class at the university, local university.
Neat.
In 1982. 1983, you know. But unfortunately, I kind of dropped out and started studying punk rock stuff and started playing a lot back then.
So but, how did you get your Japanese member in the group?
How did I get him in the group? Yeah. He just kind of hung out with us and that was it.
Yeah. That was it.
Yeah. We kind of hung out. Like, hey, man, you know, I was working on a few demos that at the time, at that transition time, and he really liked it. You know, the vibe, and it was really cool, you know? It happened to be into that kind of music, you know what I'm saying? So it worked out. He was playing part-time with another kind of, I don't want to say, it's kind of like a trashy Lower East Side band, this British dude, Thomas Ribeiro. He was kind of like a, how do you even say this? Like, not kind of Terrence Trent D'Arby rock kind of thing. But anyway, he was into that kind of soul stuff anyway, so it worked out pretty well.
That's neat. Yeah, I just was wondering how he fit in, like how you made it work or how he fit in.
Easily. That's the crux of the whole thing right there, is our relationship with him, you know, is he holds it together between us. So, you know, and like I say, it's a good conduit musically, you know.
Well, there's a really good, it's changing subjects really quickly. There's a really good exhibit, a Basquiat exhibit here, and it's free.
Really?
It's free in LA. Yeah, LA has some really, and I mean, it's not like the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which I've never been, but they have some really, really great museums here in LA, but they have the Basquiat's on exhibit, and you can just walk right in. It's free. And it's interesting because they put him next to the Warhols.
Oh, yeah.
So if you're walking through, you're like, you see the art kind of change, and then you're like looking at Warhol, and then it kind of blends into his. It's interesting how they set that up.
I'm pretty sure his sister didn't do that.
I seriously doubt it. I didn't get to catch it when they were touring around, one that the sisters put together. And I just didn't. I felt weird about paying for it when I could see so much of it here and just walk in and see it. Like, I had mixed feelings about it. Did you see it? The exhibit that the sisters put together?
Yeah, it was down the street from where I lived at. I live at on East Village.
Mm-hmm. Because they came here. They came to LA with it too. I didn't.
Yeah. Fantastic, man. You know, it's just hard to believe that, like, you know, like they let him go like that though. You know what I'm saying? You know? It's so close to meeting people like that though. In that, actually, the guy who did our first video, I can't remember his name. He was with him before he came to do our video or something like that. You know, Basquiat before, the night before or some shit like that.
Mm.
But we were all in the frame of people that, you know, like, you know, D-Light, the group D-Light.
Yes, of course.
We had the same management as D-Light. And I got to play with D-Light on a few things. And then I played with Ultranate. You know who that is, Ultranate?
I do.
Yeah, I played on some demos with her and a few. This song, Don't Mess With My Man. Oh, Lucy Pearl.
Lucy Pearl. I haven't heard that
name
in a long time.
Yeah, I played a Lucy Pearl song. I played on that remix. And I played on Dead Prez's song, Selling Dope.
Did you?
Yeah, okay. for that song, that movie, Slam.
Yes, I love Slam. That's the movie that made me fall in love with Brother Man. I was like, oh man, this is the epitome.
All my friends own it.
Of Black Madness. I was like, and now, like, his whole aesthetic is a little bit different than what I remember. But that was one of my crushes growing up because of Slam.
All my friends are on there.
Really? That's interesting.
All of them. All that little spoken word scene. We used to have one called the nigga section.
Oh no.
It was a poetry section where it started off, we used to call it 40 Ounce Friday, but then it got righteous and nobody wanted to drink anymore. So we used to go up and pass around the book and read poetry and stuff like that.
You said, then it got righteous. Love that. That's awesome. You're like, then they just cleaned us up and, you know, straightened us out.
Oh, my God.
That's interesting how you put that.
Hello, he's back.
Johnny Taylor. Hey, we haven't. We'll talk about that after the recording. I have a question. Okay, go ahead. Is it that time?
Well, it's my least favorite part of the show. It's the part where the DJ starts to say, well, you ain't got to go home, but you can't stay here. And make sure you tip your waitresses on the way out. We are coming to the point to where we are about 3 minutes to our hour. So this is the point where you get to plug everything. Where can people contact you? How can people keep up with your journey out here? How do people connect with you on socials? Any upcoming, well, we talked about some of what's going on right here, but we'll probably create a separate clip for just this one part. So this is the time to go ahead and reiterate the stuff. Okay. Make the sell.
Okay, we're touring in April with the Chameleons, UK, East Coast tour starting in Minneapolis. Then we're going to have a release, hopefully, in February of our next LP, Evergreen. And hopefully for Record Store Day, there'll be another one called, what was it? Cosmica? Oh, La Femme. I can't remember the name right now because I can't remember the name. But anyway, it's going to be another EP out. And then we're going to have like a couple of like live things we're going to do too on recording. So that's about it.
And where can people find your music or find you if they want to?
Instagram, Facebook, Bandcamp, especially Bandcamp, you know, some Spotify, but they didn't really pay us for that. So if you can hit Bandcamp up, we really appreciate it, you know, and we have merch on it as well.
Look at, would you stop that?
Spotify gets the thumbs down. Spotify gets the thumbs down. Sorry, it's just what it is. Man. You know what? With seconds left, I don't even want to get on that soapbox right now. I just don't want to.
I need a drink for that one.
Ah. Uh-oh.
Right. Okay. A few. Man, you know, that's a whole separate episode. That's a whole separate thing. But you know what? We're going to leave on a high. This has been an incredible episode. Appreciate you stopping by and sharing the stories and gracing us with your presence. We really do appreciate you making a little time to hang out with us here at the Punkdemic Podcast. So until next time, everyone, be kind to your mind and each other. And we're signing off. We out of here like last year.
There it is.
I should probably wait like 2 weeks to say that one. You should probably wait. That one was a little premature.
Just leave it alone.
We'll work on that. We'll be better on the exit for 2026. All right.
Leave it alone.
Yeah. No. It can't be. We can't do that. That's not what the people want.
Good day.
All right, I'm done harassing Amazon and all you guys that are listening. Signing off until next time. All right, I'm pushing the button.